This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On Jobs Report Friday, what is going on with wages? Baby boomers are big business, and what income inequality looks like? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday the 1st of August, and it's great to have you with us. We'll kick things off, as we do most Fridays, by talking about the week that was. 4 minutes of live radio we call the Weekly Wrap. And in our New York studios, we've got Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine and Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville. Hey, guys.
Hi, David.
Hey, David.
How you doing? All right, let's start with the jobs numbers, the big news of the day. The Labor Department says that in July, 209,000 jobs created. Lee, let me start with you. What should we make of these numbers?
It's a pretty good number. It's the sixth straight month that we've added more than 200,000 jobs. And, you know, I think we're starting to really see some sustainable, because that's the thing with the jobs number. For a long time, if you remember, it was up and it was down. It was up and it was down. And we couldn't make a trend of it. But this really feels like things are starting to solidify. And I think, really interestingly, there were a lot of re-entrants this time around, which, you know, means that people are coming back from the sidelines. And one of the biggest fears from this whole recession has been that people are going to drop out permanently or the long-term unemployed or such an issue, and there was some positive signal there. So I think all in all, it's a good number.
Cardiff, you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, whisper it softly because I don't want to jinx it, but I am finally starting to feel a little bit better. I think this is further confirmation that the slump we had in the first 3 months of the year really was a temporary kind of weather-stricken pause. And so what we've seen now is that, as Lee said, we're now averaging about 230,000 jobs created each month. Last year, that was just a little bit more than 190,000. So the pace is better. I think this is nothing to get complacent about just yet. The economy still has a lot of problems. I'd say the labor market is healing. It's not healthy, but it's healing.
All right, that's the labor market. Let's talk about the other markets. I won't whisper here, but it was a down week, and you know, a lot of funny stuff was happening. Cardiff, you know, what should we make of that?
Yeah, you know, I guess I would say this. You know, we've had in the markets about 5 or 6 months of pretty steady gains. Every once in a while, they're going to unwind a little bit. It's going to be for there are reasons that are just kind of difficult to disentangle. And so I don't think this is anything to get worked up about. I think this is still just something that you're going to see now and again. Maybe there are worries about geopolitics. Maybe there are worries that they just got out a little bit ahead of themselves. Maybe they're worried about monetary policy changing. But whatever the case, this isn't the kind of move to freak out about. This is just kind of a normal thing to happen. If anything, what was abnormal was the steadiness, the low volatility that we had in the first half of the year.
You know, Lee, one thing investors were paying attention to, some attention to at least, were the minutes from the Federal Reserve that came out this week. What was in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Fed, you know, got confirmation this week that the economy is really meeting their objectives and things seem to be on track. And, you know, I think as we get closer to October, when the Fed might pull back the stimulus, I think there's going to be more panicking. And maybe that explains some of this week's activity. But I agree with Cardiff. I mean, the market was really almost too pretty to look at in a way. I mean, it was
scarily
like,
quiet.
It was like that person in your office who's so sunny all the time, and you know that they're you know, you just want to see a little bit of frisson, you know. But I think from the Fed perspective, we, you know, things are as expected, I think. I don't think there was any surprises there.
Cardiff, just lastly here, it's the beginning of August. A lot of people are going on vacation. That includes our 400-plus lawmakers. What do they have
you,
to show for themselves here as they head back to their – and me as well. But what do the lawmakers have to show for themselves as they head out of Washington?
Well, it's too bad. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done. But I, you know, can I ask this? I mean, was anybody surprised that they didn't, you know, push through a big immigration reform package or even get done the sort of simple task of allocating more money or holding votes on so much of the work they had left to do? This isn't a surprise. This is something that we've been experiencing for the last couple of years.
All right. Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville and Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine. Thank you, guys, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, David. You too.
On Wall Street today, markets were down across the board, ending a down week, as we said. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. We were just talking about the monthly jobs report that came out this morning showed that the number of jobs added in the month that just ended decreased slightly. But the overall trend is that we're on a slow but steady jobs recovery. Still, there's a deeper issue here in what you might call the quantity versus quality department. While more Americans seem to be finding work, average wages are barely keeping up with inflation. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has more on why that is.
In an economy slowly plodding out of recession, where there still aren't enough jobs to go around, people get kind of desperate. Meaning, if you're an employer,
you've got many applicants. You don't have to bid up wages to attract qualified people.
Joshua Shapiro is chief U.S. economist at MFR, a financial consulting firm. He says, sure, in some specialized fields like computer programming, there's a shortage of skilled workers, so wages are still growing. But for most Americans,
the broad garden variety worker in the United States, wages are not accelerating.
Wage growth should eventually accelerate, at least a little, if the number of jobs keeps accelerating, too. But beyond those supply and demand dynamics of the labor market, there are deeper forces working against wage growth, ones that got started way before the Great Recession. Declining union power, globalization. Joseph Blasi is a professor of management at Rutgers University.
The sheltered economy that the U.S. had after World War II, which allowed us to have high wages and high benefits, is now being tamped down by countries with cheaper wages competing against American manufacturers.
And it's not just in manufacturing. Increasingly lower-end white-collar jobs like paralegals, draftsmen for architects are being outsourced too. Meanwhile, many of the service jobs that still can't be sent overseas because they need someone on site stocking a shelf or flipping a hamburger, they have traditionally had low wages to begin with. Damon Silvers with the AFL-CIO says workers in those industries have been starting to demand higher wages, but
everything you see going on right now in terms of worker protest at Walmart, at fast foods, even those people kind of want to know, is this going to work?
One way or another, economist Joseph Shapiro says we should all hope that wages will rise eventually for workers.
Because that's who buys stuff.
And buying stuff is ultimately what keeps our economy running. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
It's been a hot summer for the auto industry. Car makers reported their July sales today, and it turns out we snapped up nearly 1.5 million cars last month. That's an increase of around 9% over this time last year, and it puts us on track to buy more than 16 million cars by the end of 2014. That would be the biggest auto sales number in 8 years. What's driving all this? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
One of the big reasons car sales are so high this year is that banks have discovered the sweet business that is the auto loan, says Larry Veliquette with Automotive News in Detroit.
Banks have realized that when recessions hit, people may stop paying their mortgage payment because it takes so long to get thrown out of your house, but very few stop paying their car payment because those are easy to repossess and you have to be able to get to work.
And car makers have done their part to sweeten that pot too, says Veliquette.
For example, Ram on one of its trucks has a 0% financing offer for 72 months. I mean, 6 years of free money and no payments for 90 days. That's a really attractive offer.
And it's an offer many consumers have been waiting for. The average car on the road is more than a decade old. That's an all-time high. Tilo Kozlovsky is an auto analyst with Gartner. He says all this pent-up demand is making for a golden age for the auto industry.
We're coming out of this really depressing time when we had the big financial crisis, where a lot of people were just delaying their vehicle purchases.
But cheap money and easy loans have some seeing signs of a bubble. Dan Picciotto is an auto analyst with Standard & Poor's. He says the economic fundamentals seem solid in the industry for now. But he says the deep discounts and less than sterling loans need to be kept in check.
Right now, the industry is remaining relatively disciplined. But, you know, the track record of this industry is one that the risks emerge. It's something that we continue to monitor.
The average rebate on a vehicle in July was more than $2,700. That's up 7% from last year. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, a photographer's observations on the haves and the have-nots.
I think it's really easy to characterize the poor as always wanting what the rich have, and the rich as being uncaring about the poor.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 69 points, 0.4% to finish at 16,493. The NASDAQ lost 17 points, more than a third percent to settle at 4,352. And the S&P 500 ticked down 5 points, more than 0.25% to end at 1925. A few companies had better-than-expected profits today. LinkedIn improved its profile more than 11%. Expedia clicked up 6.25%, and Procter & Gamble climbed 3%. I'll give you an update on that in just a couple of minutes. Japan's Nikkei was down 0.67%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 2.49%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. African heads of state or government are expected in Washington for the first U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. What's in Michael Kors' wallet? The company releases quarterly earnings. And International Clown Week continues. Kind of scary and fun all at once. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Procter & Gamble made a big announcement today. The Cincinnati-based company makes more consumer products than any other company in the world. And it's announced it's going to divest itself, sell, or discontinue more than half its brands, 90 to 100 of them. P&G started in the 19th century with just one product, soap. So how did it get this big, and why has it decided to slim down? Sally Herships reports.
Two ingredients. That's all Procter & Gamble needed to launch its enormous empire of brands.
Fat and oils.
Fat and oils. David Steyer is co-author of Rising Tide, Lessons from 165 Years of Brand Building at Procter & Gamble.
Originally, those were the key ingredients of soap.
Ivory, to be exact. Dyer says once P&G worked what, at the time, was considered business magic, branding a commodity like soap, it took its technology and moved on to shortening, peanut butter, detergents. The rest is corporate history. But now P&G is getting rid of lots of brands it worked hard to develop.
I'm actually surprised it's taken this long.
Barbara Kahn teaches marketing at Wharton. She says the company has a lot of redundant products, like shampoo, not just Head & Shoulders, but also Herbal Essences, Pantene, and Vidal Sassoon, which, when you think about marketing, used to make sense.
So it used to be three networks, and everybody watched Ed Sullivan on Sunday night, and women who stayed at home and watched soap operas.
Kahn says it was much easier to build brand awareness then than now. Markets today are increasingly global, which can be increasingly difficult for companies like Procter & Gamble. Erin Lash is an equity analyst with Morningstar.
Some of their struggles have resulted from the fact that they have maybe tried to get into too many categories in too many regions.
Lash says tastes and preferences vary. You can't always take a product like razors that work in the U.S. and easily transport it to an emerging market. Procter & Gamble hasn't announced which brands it will be shaving away, but the company does say the products it's holding on to account for almost all of its profit. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Wall Street has set its sights on baby boomers. Banks and financial advisors are eager to have them as clients to get a slice of the trillions they've saved up for retirement. And to be fair, many boomers could use advice. They're facing the most challenging retirement landscape in history, one that's complicated by longer lifespans and the slow disappearance of pensions. All this has led to a new field. It's called financial gerontology. Here's Marketplace's Mark Garrison.
How are you supposed to know what you're supposed to do?
Sandy and Jim DeBetancourt are going through their finances around their dining room table in Skokie, Illinois. It's not a simple picture. Just like for most Americans, it's more of a puzzle made up of piles of paper and scrolling screens of online text and graphs. It's a lot more complicated than what their parents had to deal with.
My dad never had to do this.
Sandy's 58 and teaches second grade, which means she expects a pension. But she also understands that pensions are not such a sure bet these days.
I started kind of worrying about whether I was going to have enough money.
Jim is 62, a tech consultant and teacher. His resume is typical. He worked at several places, which means several different retirement accounts.
I have a separate 403b fund.
Lately, they've sought professionals to help sort this out and plan ahead.
So it's partially become way too complicated to really understand what's going on, and it's very hard to figure out who you should trust.
I can't find
the email from...
Right, an email from...
You'd expect their bank might have tried to earn that trust and win that business, but it didn't happen that way.
Up until about 5 or 6 years ago, we did not really hear from anybody at all.
These days, they get pitched all the time. They get all sorts of flyers in the mail and see endless ads on their favorite shows and websites from big financial firms.
Now I feel like they're marketing towards me.
They certainly are. We can get a peek at just how hard Wall Street is gunning for older Americans inside a corner meeting room in a tower high above Midtown Manhattan.
If you could, just tell me, you know, what you found, what you pulled out of that was so important.
A lot of people who are approaching the traditional retirement age.
Bank executive Cindy Hutchins is talking strategy with Jeff James, a longtime financial advisor with many older clients. She's got quite a title.
I am the Director of Financial Gerontology for Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
Director of Financial Gerontology. That's a brand new position, previously unheard of at big financial firms. Its mere existence demonstrates how seriously the company takes the older demographic. Other banks and advisories are getting in the game, too, because a lot of money is up for grabs.
It's $22 trillion that will be money in motion over the next several years with these clients that are retiring.
That's $22 trillion with a T. Financial advisors profit based on how much money they manage, typically around 1%. So Wall Street is looking at a $220 billion haul.
It's not a small opportunity. It's a huge market that we're looking at.
Wall Street's racing to figure out what today's older Americans need and how to win their business. The aggressive push worries those who look out for retirees.
Weeding out who's giving them good advice and who's trying to take their money away from them is a real challenge right now.
AARP Executive Vice President Deborah Whitman worries about companies gunning for retirees, often with a confusing array of options. One false move in financial planning can ripple for decades.
Reverse mortgages or long-term care insurance, annuities, each one is a pretty complicated financial instrument and it's a pretty complicated decision. And they're not right for everybody. So understanding what each person needs really takes a lot of advice and help.
Whitman says older Americans and their families really need to do their homework before choosing an advisor.
And then we have to decide whether we're
back at the DeBetancourt dining room in Illinois and in millions of other American homes, this isn't about bank profits or a marketing opportunity or some interesting demographic trend. It's their life, and it's a little scary.
It is our money. It's going to make a huge difference come down the road if we don't make those good decisions. It's going to affect everybody in the long run,
not just the people who say, oh, well, yeah, I'm sorry it was a bad product. We made lots of money. I'm sorry you didn't.
You or someone you love is living this high-stakes financial gerontology experiment right now, the very thing Wall Street wants in on. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Was published in the early 80s, a book of photographs called Rich and Poor. Over several years, Jim Goldberg took portraits in San Francisco of people from both classes in the houses, apartments, and hotel rooms where they lived. Goldberg got his subjects to write on those portraits, to react to them, the way they looked, the way they felt, and that handwritten text makes each image even more powerful. Rich and Poor had been out of print since 1985, but Goldberg, who's been digitizing all his photos, redesigned the book, expanded it, and now it's available again. Jim joins us now. Hey, Jim.
Hi.
I wonder if you could take me back to the mid-70s when you started this project and tell me a bit about how it came about, how you decided to do this.
I actually made this work as a way to apply to graduate school here in San Francisco. Uh-huh. I had been photographing people in transient hotels in the Mission District, decided to have them write on the photographs. And I used the combination of text and image as a way to apply to graduate school and get in, actually. But in doing this work, I was interested in looking at the ways that we speak, you know, about wealth and poverty. Most economics is descriptive. You know, it comes from the outside. But when I was first doing Rich and Poor, a lot of the work that was being done, especially documentary photography or photojournalism and the like, was that way too. So I certainly wanted to open up the discussion and ask interesting questions about how discussions of wealth and poverty are framed and the language that's used to describe them and who gets to use that language.
I was struck looking through the section on the poor at how many of these subjects thanked you or expressed their affection or love for you. What was your relationship like with them? Did you keep in touch with them throughout those 8 years?
I'm thinking because many of them disappeared over that period of time. So as much as I would try to be present in their lives, they would have to move on or disappear or go to prison or die. I mean, not to be dramatic, but that the life of the poor is somewhat dramatic in that sense. Whereas the wealthy were, as I became more established as an artist, our worlds tend to coincide more. So I would see them at openings or at museums, or they would collect my work. So it was an interesting contradiction.
Bridging these two chapters, if you will, the two sections, let's say, are a series of photographs. There's at least one wealthy person and then often his servant or his maid. And here, as you talk about the text, that these are some of the most illuminating ones for me because you have the wealthy person writing and then the poor employee writing as well. I bring this up because I wonder about the degree to which the poor talked about the rich and the rich talked about the poor when you were photographing them. Was there an awareness, I suppose an aspirational awareness, that many of the poor subjects had? Was there any sort of awareness among the rich subjects that you photographed?
I think it's really easy to characterize the poor as always wanting what the rich have and the rich as being uncaring about the poor. Mm. I mean, that may be true for some, but not all. I think that the poor, most of them wanted a life that in which they could have a home and a place of security. And the rich who had that security and had that home were dealing with other kinds of issues of, you know, raising families and investments and all those things that are, you know, that the poor didn't have a chance to deal with. And so I'm hesitant to say that the rich were oblivious to what was going on around them, but certainly the places that they live and they shop and they travel in often allows them not to see what's going on in the underbelly, but the have-nots of the city.
Let me ask you what San Francisco wealth was like in the 70s and 80s. I think, you know, since then we've had such a boom in tech wealth. It's a younger wealth. It's sure. a newer wealth. For so long, the wealth in San Francisco was old money. I mean, there are folks that you photograph who say they were born into wealth. They know nothing else mm-hmm. besides it. Mm-hmm. These were people who had streets named after them. Maybe you can just talk a bit about the distinction or that change between, old money and new money, for lack of better terms.
Well, in a sense, some could say, and this may be debatable, that the wealthy look poor compared to where they are now. I mean, they had automatic door openers, but they didn't have the cell phones and the computers and the technology that's allowed people to have more leisure time in their lives. There is something that's as if because the income gap has grown exponentially between the wealthy and the poor, I think the wealthy now, because there's so much more money around, are able to exhibit or show their wealth in ways that the wealthy of the past could not. But that's my observation as a visual person.
Jim Goldberg is a photographer in San Francisco. We were talking about his book, Rich and Poor. Jim, thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, an artist in England, a woman by the name of Lucy Sparrow, whose bio, by the way, says she, quote, sets the agenda for textiles within the urban art scene. Someone's got to do it. Lucy has created something called the Corner Shop, which is being billed as the fluffiest, furriest shopping experience imaginable. You walk into what was an abandoned store, and everything that you'd find in a convenience store, and I mean everything, is in there, but it's made entirely out of felt, out of fabric. She's sewn felt newspapers and magazines, felt cigarettes, felt fruit and vegetables. The artist spent 7 months doing this, and the whole thing really does look amazing. You can see some pictures on our website. That's at marketplace.org. The Corner Shop will be open for a month, and I should add, each of those 4,000-some-odd felt objects is for sale. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 69 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq lost 17 points, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.